Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture.
What does it really take to scale a founder-led hospitality business? And how do you make tough decisions when your reputation and livelihood are on the line? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Stuart Gillies, founder behind Number 8 Sevenoaks and Bankhouse Chislehurst, independent restaurants rooted in seasonal cooking, thoughtful hospitality, and strong local communities. Stuart is the former CEO of the Gordon Ramsay Group, where he helped lead one of the UK's most recognisable hospitality brands through a major transformation, experience he now draws on in building his own ventures. Stuart offers a rare perspective on what it takes to move from chef to CEO, make high-stakes decisions in hospitality, and build resilient businesses in one of the toughest industries there is. Well, today on All About Business, I couldn't be more delighted than to welcome Stuart Gillies. Stuart is a chef, restaurateur, and former CEO of the Gordon Ramsay Group. He currently runs, with his wife Cecilia, two famous restaurants, Number 8 in Sevenoaks and the Bankhouse in Chislehurst. You've got an amazing story that I'm looking forward to sort of excavating, Stuart, and I'm looking forward to hearing all about your journey. But I just looked up, Number 8 in Sevenoaks on my computer just before you came, and it's very highly rated, Google 4.7 out of 5. But I noticed on TripAdvisor that there are 103 restaurants in Sevenoaks. So how do you stand out? How do you compete? How do you make a business work in such an environment? That's my first question, because I think it might begin
a conversation at the top.
In an interesting way. Yeah.
Well, thank you for inviting me today.
That's a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, I didn't know there were that many restaurants in Sevenoaks.
Neither did I. I was amazed.
We don't spend a lot of our time looking out, I'll be honest. We look in. And that's, I suppose, the essence of what we do. Every day we look at what we do as a business. And if it's good enough for us, then we hope people like it. And we are really tough on detail, micro detail, attention to detail, team, energy, atmosphere, all the 360 of what going out and hospitality is that we've learned, my wife and I. So I wouldn't have known there were 103 restaurants. We notice new competition when it comes, and we look at it and we take a view. But generally, we're always judging ourselves, I would say. Looking internally, judging the food, the drinks, the atmosphere, the team, the way people engage, so that when people arrive, it's unique and it's got something that is almost living. It's got a heartbeat, and that's what we've always done with our businesses.
Right. And you've got a 30-year career history in hospitality. You've obviously learned a lot along the way, coming to this point where you now focus so much on detail. Where did you begin, and what were your first lessons?
Well, I wasn't born into hospitality. The youngest of four kids, Glaswegian parents who weren't foodies at all. We were brought up on, the famous smash from Mash Get Smash.
That brilliant advert
from the 70s. That and boiled mince was a pretty normal meal at our house. And a posh dinner was steak at the weekend that my dad would get. Right. And I'd get offcuts. So I didn't have a culinary upbringing at all. We'd go up to Glasgow quite regularly, see cousins and things, and eat aship pie and tatty scone and fruit slice. That was super exciting to me as a young kid from Crawley in Sussex. So it was only really when it was mid-80s and the recession was on and Thatcher was trying to rebuild the country, and I managed to get on a YTS scheme, which was £25 a week. You work 5 days, you go to college one day, and you have one day off. And that gave me an entrance into a kitchen, local kitchen.
See, I think they should be doing this now.
Yeah, absolutely.
YTS, it was something equivalent scheme. Because you're not the first guest on our podcast who started on a YTS scheme and went on to do brilliant things.
Yeah, because it didn't cost the employers anything. They had two or three kids who came in on the scheme I was 17. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. Stayed on for a year at school. My brother was a chef at the airport, Gatwick. So, it's a good laugh in the kitchen. Go and try it out. And I went in and tried it and loved it, even though I'd never had anything to do with food. I just loved the atmosphere.
So you're 17 at this point.
17, went in on the YTS scheme, worked a year, and at the end of the year was lucky enough to get taken on. Of the three kids, they choose one to keep on.
So where was this?
This was in Crawley in Sussex.
But what was it, a restaurant? Oh,
it was a local Crest Hotel. Right. So do you remember there was a group called the Crest Hotel Group?
Right.
And they had a hotel there with a kitchen, old style 80s kitchen.
So you're cooking breakfast for people and stuff?
You're doing everything really, you know, and the chefs drank beer and it was rock and roll 80s kitchens, you know, while working. Yeah. And I just thought this is completely normal. Yeah. But the head chef was really good. He was really talented, a guy called David Woods. And he said to me, if you're going to make something of this career, get yourself to London. And so he introduced me to someone who was at the Royal Garden Hotel. And I went and worked at the Royal Garden Hotel in Kensington, and that finished my apprenticeship at Westminster College. So that was my 3 years of 706, one and two, City and Guilds. And then finished my year at the Royal Garden and met a lot of chefs that I was, then in contact.
So when you completed your apprenticeship, what sort of qualification did you have?
So you get a City and Guilds, 706, one and two.
Right.
That's what they're called, which was the basic of that era.
So that means you can go to a kitchen and...
It's a really good qualification, actually. Yeah. You have to study, you have to pass, you have to do well to achieve that. It was a basic. I think it was a lot higher level on expectation than the NVQ certificates are now. So that was just standard. And it was full-time 2 years or 3 years part-time apprenticeship, which is what I did, the apprenticeship.
So that's your entry ticket to good jobs in hospitality.
Yeah, pretty much. That was it. So that gave me the basic tools as a chef, qualifications. And my end of my third year, I'd been working all those years as a young chef, and all my friends were doing other jobs and earning three times the money and had double the time off. And I was working with a whole massive team at the Royal Garden, because back then the kitchens had about 45, 50 chefs in the brigade. They were huge teams of people. And I... met a Swedish girl named Andrea, and we got together and started seeing each other, and she was heading back to Sweden at that time, and I was just finishing my year. So she said, why don't you come back with me? A boy from Crawley who'd never really been anywhere except London to get the chance to go to Sweden and have an adventure.
Leave all those friends so behind who are showing off about how much they were earning.
Yeah, well, it was great.
Go somewhere
more
exciting.
Well, I was just so excited at the opportunity to grow and do something else and travel. So I went to Sweden with Andrea. And when I got to Sweden, all the Swedes were a completely different culture to the British back then. They are all about outdoor health and travel. And they're huge travelers. You know, they were traveling the globe in big chunks of 3 months, 12 months. And so... when you live in that culture, and I was completely immersed in that culture, you know, I didn't know any English people. I stayed away from English people. I was just living with my girlfriend and her sister. I worked with Swedish people. So I learned Swedish fluently within a year. And I only immersed myself in that culture. And I found I had a real gift for language. I found I had an ear that didn't materialize at school when I was being bashed with a book and reading off the blackboard. But immersed into it fully.
And you were working in a
Working in a restaurant, fantastic restaurant in Stockholm, actually, called Riche Restaurant.
Different food, I imagine.
It was different food, and the kitchen was full of Austrians and Germans and Swiss, who were the best cooks in the world back then. Back in late 80s, they were phenomenal cooks. And they were just doing things and understanding food and produce and attention to detail that didn't really exist in London at all back then. So I loved Sweden. I loved the culture, I loved the lifestyle, I loved the food in the restaurant. I loved working with these guys who were super strict, very Germanic in their manner, that everything was incredibly disciplined and meticulous.
Right.
And just their knowledge was phenomenal. So I had a fantastic year working with them in Sweden. Then I came back to the UK, sort of family, spent a few months here, and then I went off to Italy. To Rome, actually.
And you learned Italian, I imagine.
Yeah, learned Italian. it just happened. Back then, you could take a one-way trip. So I basically saved up money for a few months.
I guess you still can. With Brexit, you can't get to work so easily.
Yeah, that's the thing. So back then, I had a one-way ticket and about £300, went out there, and 3-4 days in, I didn't have enough to fly back.
Right.
So I started knocking on doors everywhere, all over the city, and... eventually got sent to a place called the Lord Byron, which was a beautiful white marble hotel behind a park in Rome called Villa Borghese.
Sounds quite British.
Well, it was named after Byron, of course. Yeah. Almost serendipitous. In the direction. And I arrived there and they just said, okay, come back tomorrow. And we didn't discuss money or job or anything. They just said, come back tomorrow.
If, like me, you run a business or manage a team, you'll know how important it is to hire great people. Over the last 65 years, Reed has worked with thousands of businesses around the world, helping them to recruit and to grow. This is what inspired us to create Reed.ai, your new AI hiring agent. It's here to save you money, to save you time, and to help you get the right match. Whether you're hiring your first team member or your 50th, Reed AI is here to make it easier. Go to Reed.ai and get started. Reed.ai, your higher power.
So I went back the next day, and then I moved in a few days later with one of the waiters.
Right.
Because I was running out of money. I was living in a hostel. And so I slept on his floor for about 4 weeks in Rome, traveled to work with him, just worked and worked and worked and started to learn Italian. And
so what I'm hearing here, Stuart, you know, as a young man, you really went out to learn and expose yourself to different sort of experiences, cultures, kitchens, and you were benefiting from being in a different environment with people with different approaches to work that you'd perhaps been with before, from whom you learned a huge amount in Italy, in Sweden. Completely, and this is a good thing for young people to consider now, when, you know, the environment for young people is quite tough to get jobs, but you were really prepared to go out and give it a go and, you know, sleep on someone's floor for a few weeks if it was necessary.
I wasn't fazed by anything, and I expected things to be tough and failure was inevitable. But from that young age, because I'd never really, as a young kid and in that family, and never really, apart from sports, I did a lot of sports as a kid. I'd never really achieved anything as such. So I had nothing to lose.
Yes.
I had no fear of failing or not looking good or someone thinking, oh, you're rubbish at this. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered like that. All I was interested in was going ahead and just learning.
So you weren't phased, and you weren't afraid of failing.
Wasn't afraid of failing. Wasn't afraid of being on my own. I was quite comfortable in my own environment. Willing to take risk, language, people laughing at you, because that's what happens when you go abroad. You know, you have to have really thick skin and just move on. You can't be sensitive because it's an English cook in the 80s in Europe. Trust me, we were a laughing stock.
The butt of jokes.
Were the butt of jokes. And when I arrived in Rome and was in the kitchen, I was never called Stuart once. In all the time I worked in Rome,
really?
They called me l'inglese.
L'inglese?
Where's l'inglese? Dove l'inglese? Cosa fai l'inglese? Yeah, all the time. It was just constant. And it didn't bother me because I was just learning. I was just eating, learning.
Yeah.
And Rome was like, it was literally like a magical storybook of, if you could find the most amazing place to go and work and indulge, where would it be? That would be the storybook. Because people would come on a bicycle in the morning and bring produce in a box. They'd have a coffee. They'd have a grappa. They'd talk about produce. And then the next person would come and the truffles would be in a little cloth. And everything was so romantic and incredible. Because I'd never seen food like that. Coming from London and the UK and even Sweden, you didn't get produce like I saw in Rome. That produce was just mind-blowing. And that was what gave me the benchmark for the future of taste.
Right.
Because I ate things there that were just incredible. They were what I call those life moments when it's just a showstopper. You eat it and everything stops. It's just, oh my God, that tastes incredible. That tomato or that apple or that.
So you can still think of moments in Rome when you tasted something.
Yeah, the nostalgic memory of that, that flavor point. Yeah, I don't think it ever goes away.
And that informs you to this day.
Completely, yeah. That's my benchmark. If it doesn't taste as good as that with this
memory. It's hard to get the produce, isn't it?
It is. Well, it's come on a long way. You can get phenomenal produce here. And you get a lot of rubbish produce, no doubt. You get that everywhere these days. But I think if you haven't tasted something at its best, at maximum level, then you're never going to shoot that high and get close to achieving that. So I think that was the thing. And I didn't know where that was taking me back then. It was all a hodgepodge of, you know, the Germans and Austrians in Sweden, the travel, the produce in Italy, and the attention to detail on how they start the risotto, how they make the pasta by hand. You know, it was small things that were a whole mix of detail that didn't come together until years later. when I worked in New York, actually, which then was a catalyst.
Okay. So let's fast forward. So you ended up leaving Rome and going to New York.
No, it was years later.
Years later.
I was really busy in between.
Busy where?
Well, I backpacked. After Italy, I stopped working for 5 months and backpacked South America. Back in London, yeah. It was about 25. I'd done lots of years of traveling, James, in and out, back to Sweden, Italy, South America, and then got to the point I was done. I'd had enough of living out of a bag. I'd seen a lot of things. I'd seen a lot of danger. And I was at a point where I decided I needed to get my career on track. So I went to work at a place called Gravetye Manor down in Sussex. Spent 18 months there, split shifts, back into the routine of being a chef, working all day. So I met Marcus Waring. He was there as a young cook. And from Gravetye Manor, I then went to Le Caprice.
Right.
Which back in early 90s wasn't really known at all, actually. It was only known to the elite of society. And the billionaires of the world all knew Le Caprice because they all went there. Chris and Jeremy had this incredible place they'd built at the bottom of Arlington Street. And it was full all day with every A-lister in the world would go to Le Caprice when they came to London. So Le Caprice was 2.5 years, which was phenomenal for me. Just working with Mark Hicks, Tim Hughes, and a whole team that were there.
A really famous team.
It was a bunch of phenomenal cooks who were just cooking all the time. Super fresh produce, as well as the staples of Le Caprice menu, which were the Caesar salad, the fish cake, the bang bang chicken. There was all these staples that all the regulars loved, from Peter Stringfellow to Princess Diana to Leslie Waddington. That these were their...
So you sort of knew what they'd order when they came.
So they knew, yeah. They looked after them. It was their place. It was incredibly consistent, and that was their place. Yeah. And then you had all the others who came because it was Le Caprice. So the menu changed regularly. It was incredible artisan and British produce that we were using all the time, rotating. So I spent 2.5 years there as a sous chef, which was fantastic entry, I think, into that style of food, which was all ingredient-led. Very much regular changing, adapt things all the time, rather than the serious level of Michelin where you don't do that. So Michelin is get perfection and just repeat. Okay. So Le Caprice was much more risky, much more off the cuff, but phenomenal food. And from there, I was at the level of sous chef and thought, well, head chef is obviously next. I'm in a serious zone. I'm really focused. But London's not giving me anything exciting. Everybody in London is feeding off each other. They're all going to each other's places. They're all repeating and copying what everyone else does. So I looked out at what was around and heard of this place called Danielle in New York, which was top five in the world. Danielle Boulud was creating a sensation with his style of cooking and wrote a letter to him. In fact, I did the draft letter and Jeremy King offered to help, and he looked at the letter I wrote and said, "It's not really punchy enough, Stuart. You know, this is a guy in America. You got to regale him with, you know, you got to pamper his ego a lot more." So Jeremy helped me write the letter, which was stunning.
That's nice. It was phenomenal.
Yeah. It was like nothing I could have written. And clearly it had an impact because it went over there and I heard nothing, and then decided I was going to go there instead and meet him and confront him nicely, politely, turn up, have lunch, say, "Oh, I actually wrote to you." So we did that. Me and another three of the sous chefs who worked at Le Caprice, we all went over, planned this trip, went to Union Square Cafe, which was legendary back then. And we had lunch at Danielle. And at the end of the meal, Danielle came out and spoke to us. And I said, "Oh, actually, I wrote to you, Danielle, about a job here, but I didn't hear anything back." He said, "What's your name?" So he went away and came back 2 minutes later. He said, yeah, "I've got your paperwork here. I was waiting for timing because it takes quite a long time for the J1 visa." So he said, "I've got your paperwork here. So yeah, we're looking to contact you, and you would start in September that year." And it was March at that point. So I waited a year for that job at Danielle from when I wrote. But it was
a good story about just going out and getting a job. I mean, literally going there and saying,
"Well, I wasn't taking no for an answer."
No, quite. But you were very focused on what you wanted to do and where you wanted to work and who for.
Well, yeah, I had a dream, I had an ambition, and I was determined that I would find a way to make that work. So yeah, we went out and it worked. And I spent 18 months with Danielle, which was, that was phenomenal. I mean, Danielle was the most incredible kitchen because it was full of, it was full of chefs from France and America, but the guys from France had all worked in every single top 3-star in France. and they wanted to come and live in America. So they were coming from Michel Bras, from Marc Vera. They were coming from Trois Gros, Bocuse, Lamboisier. I mean, everywhere that you would hear about and just be like, wow. So they'd all worked there. So what a stage for me as a cook to judge myself on.
You know, were you called Linglaise there or not?
No, they called me Teabag.
Teabag?
So yeah, I seem to have another nickname English nickname everywhere. Maybe they didn't like Stuart, but yes, I was Teabag there because that's what the Americans called the British.
Okay. They haven't forgotten that tea party. They've not in forgotten Boston. That.
Yeah, exactly. I was the only English who'd ever worked there. The first English guy who had actually worked there fully. So worked there 18 months with Danielle, and that was incredible. That place was the catalyst that brought together everything I'd ever seen, eating ceviche in Peru and cooking in Italy and cooking in Sweden. It just brought everything together as this mix of, you can have one style of cuisine, which was French, which was Danielle's cuisine, but you can have influences from all over the world.
Right.
And that's what he did. And he did it incredibly, really creatively. And he was a brilliant technician, Danielle. He could do volume and finesse at incredible, incredible levels. So Danielle changed my cooking career, no doubt about that. It brought everything together. And then I went back to London after that.
And then when you came back to London, your journey involved you moving from being chef to CEO.
Yes, took a few years.
Took a few years, but you went from being obviously top chef to the CEO of the Gordon Ramsay Group. Is that right?
Yeah.
So just describe that journey a little, if you might, and how that came about and what you learned.
Well, I was working as a chef director of three or four of the businesses. The business had gone through a massive transition. Gordon's father-in-law had been removed from the business, and the business was in a lot of trouble because it was 2010. On the back of the Lehman issues and the financial crash, the whole fine dining sector had gone. So that was gone. So the big, huge spending, the fat cats of the city and spending like £44,000 at Petrus. There was that story that came out back in the day. Oh,
yeah, so the wine and everything.
Yeah, which was happening all the time, and that was regular. And those businesses in that area or echelon, let's say, they were profiting brilliantly from that. They loved that because people were coming spending incredible amounts of money. So that had all gone. And I was working as a chef director of so many of the businesses in the company. So I was doing everything new anyway. And Gordon and I had a conversation. He said, look, I found someone to take over the group. I said, okay, great. Who's that going to be? And he said, someone who really knows what he's doing. I said, okay, great. And he said, that's going to be you. And I said, oh, no, I'm not ready for that. I said, I can't do that. I'm a chef and I love being a chef.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, but you talk about change, what we need to do. Yeah. I think you can do it. And but you can't say no to that opportunity.
No, you can't.
I didn't like being a chef, but that opportunity was huge to have that then. And we agreed that he would step back. I'd have pretty much a clear run to change and make the changes that I felt needed to be done and just keep him in the loop while he was in the US a lot, doing the shows, earning money to support the business, which is a really simple arrangement, but there was a lot of layers of complexity in that. And the business was, really brilliant in some areas and really damaged in other areas, like lots of businesses as you progress through the years. When things get tough, you suddenly notice what doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, and as I understand, you had to make some quite difficult decisions. You had to close some restaurants, you opened others.
So over the period I was in charge, I closed 12 businesses around the world and we opened 18.
Right.
So that was the transition. So really there was a lot of things
What were your decision points on why you decided to close something and what you were going to open?
It definitely wasn't emotional. It was just logical. For me, that sort of job, when I get into that role or even how I'd always functioned as a operator and as a chef, for me, it was just mathematics. Some things added up and some things didn't.
Right.
So you got to make decisions that are not emotional. You really need to get the facts, gather the data and make a really informed decision. So I'd always done that my whole career and probably my whole life in lots of ways, just naturally. So when I got into that role as CEO, you just have to strip back and see, you need to be able to see what the root of the problem is, get underneath the skin, get to the core of the problem, and then make a decision and move on, and then execute that. So
these were businesses you didn't really see a future, future in because the mathematics didn't add up and you couldn't see a way of turning that around.
It didn't add up financially, and it was also draining the resources, because when you have businesses in trouble, every entrepreneur and business owner, it consumes cash, and it also eats up all your time. You put way more time into a business that's doing badly than you do into a business that's doing well. That's just the facts of it. A business that's trouble, you put way more time and emotion and energy into that to fix it. A business that's going well, you just keep an eye on it and you let it tick along. So there were lots of those businesses that needed attention, and a lot of them were international deals that had been set up by other people that were just draining resource, weren't contributing financially. They were eating up Gordon's time. So you'd have to get Jordan on a plane, fly him out, take his time up, which was taking him away from things actually that were generating that were more profitable, simple as that. So those 12 were fairly easy decisions actually.
And what were you looking for in terms of opening new ventures?
Well, as I looked at it and spoke to Gordon about, so we saw that everything was branded Gordon and Ramsay, which makes sense for lots of people. But I think what I saw when I looked into the group and at the micro detail levels, I saw that everyone was hiding under the brand. And they were looking and thinking, well, if things aren't working, we'll just wait for the brand to fix it. But it wasn't. And so the people working within it had got used to the good days, big spend, high income. So that was fixing all the problems in lots of ways until you get to a point when that stopped. And so my view was, we de-brand, we create individuality, and we bring in new people to support the current team who have unique skill sets. So they're not all born of the same core central, what would we call it? I suppose, area where they've all worked together in that level of fine dining at a super high level. We need people who are diverse, who have only worked in bars or worked in brasseries or worked in different environments where they have different skill sets.
That's interesting, because that is a different business strategy to, say, recreating the Ivy in lots of places, or Cafe Rouge that was a big deal at the time, or I'm thinking of Gales now, which is a sort of
well, it's different. If you got one phenomena, if you got one thing that works and you can do the cookie cutter and mass produce it really well, then there's nothing wrong with that. That's very clever.
Yeah, but your business was not like that, you're saying.
It was different. It was already diverse.
Right.
It was already a collection of restaurants, as I called it. And it was, it as I say, it had great elements within, but there was so much noise that we had to really individualize and start to put responsibility and pressure into individuals within their bricks and mortar establishment. Right. Rather than them looking to head office and central support area. So
you wanted people to take responsibility in their
and
own
actually
kitchen location.
Be involved in the decision making.
Yeah.
And actually make decisions that were going to drive the business forward. And they would then own and manage that decision, rather than we hand down a directive or a command, so to speak, and then they would just execute it, because you just lose so much along the way.
So you were basically devolving sort of responsibility from the center to...
Yeah, well put. That's exactly what we did, to the point where I made a really unpopular decision and I changed the name of head office to support office, which was really unpopular.
Who was that unpopular with?
Obviously, head office.
The people not those people in the other block.
No, because I said, look, without the restaurants, there is no business.
Yeah, I always say at Reed, we don't have a head office.
Yeah, it's...
We don't need one.
It's a collective force, and you don't need
a head
office.
We're all one team.
Because everyone's out doing their thing but together, you're a brilliant machine, and it works brilliantly because everyone's an integral part of that machine. So that's how I explained it. And the teams understood it completely. So, right, we're as you say, devolving power to you. This is support team will help you achieve that. And you need to drive this, and you need to hit your targets, and you need to achieve. So we did that. And that then created the individuality of different brands, Bread Street Kitchen, Union Street Cafe, London House, and then all the developments in the United States with Burger, Pub. So there was lots of that individual focus on each of these businesses that then were more they were self-perpetuating to a large extent. And then the support office gave them the resources to see what was good and bad and grow that business. And that was pretty much what I spent my 8 years doing, was growing new businesses, new contracts, new relationships with Caesars, with Sands Casino Group. So CEO, it's a completely different job to being a chef. You know, I wasn't cooking. I wasn't spending time in that way with teams as I would have done before, much more focused on the artist side of the business. I was purely involved with banks, finance, costs, resources.
So that is a very different, you know, role. I mean, did you find that you could rely upon things you'd learned as chef? I mean, it does mean chief, doesn't it? Chef in French.
So being CEO, it does. Yeah, boss. Chief executive. Yeah, boss, actually.
Means
yeah.
Boss. Yeah, you're boss of a kitchen, a boss of a company. Are there sort of things you took from one to the other?
Well, definitely, yes. I just transitioned from one job to the other. People, some other people I knew outside the industry who were already CEOs, they said, you know, it's going to be the loneliest job in the world, being a CEO, because you have to make tough decisions and people won't understand those decisions, but you've got to make decisions.
Do you find that to be true?
100% is true. No. I think the things about being a CEO, there were a couple of things I really learned. First of all, it's the loneliest job in the world. And secondly, you're really up against it with regards to your strategy, depending on who you're trying to keep happy. Whether you're trying to grow the business for the future and build something, or whether you're trying to keep your shareholders happy.
Right.
Those two strategies are, in my experience, very different.
Because the shareholders had more short-term
They have
expectations.
Financial expectations.
They want dividends.
To see money.
They So they want some money. Yeah.
Well, I think in lots of businesses, you know, CEOs are really, and you don't know until you're a CEO, that you're really under that pressure. Because you go to the board meetings and it's all about money, shares, what's in it for us kind of thing. And that's what board meetings, I suppose, I've oversimplified it, but that's what they're really about.
But if you want to build something for the long term.
For the long term, it's not going
to
look pretty.
You have to make your case, don't you?
It's not going to look pretty. You're going to have to put money in. You're going to have to do things. You're going to have to break some shells. You're going to have to build. You have to structure. You have to build. And I see a lot of these companies around the world that are producing results and people say they're doing badly, but I would see that they are putting money into growth.
They're investing.
They're investing into growth. So your results aren't going to look pretty if you're building. If you're building and in growth, it's extremely unlikely the results will look pretty, because it takes money, it takes investment. And no matter what the business, you just don't know how well it's going to go. Your forecasts and your projections, they're literally just guesstimates. You take the best guess you can and you push it out there. But to the point, I think my strategy was rebuild, restructure, bring in new talent, individualize, and create then avenues that can be grown into future individual brands, things that could be segregated, whatever it might be. That was always my focus. So the debranding point wasn't to remove the name or anything that was negative to Gordon. It was creating individuality within that, which was then associated with this amazing brand just by association. Which, when we did Savoy Grill, that was the last restaurant that I was in charge of as a chef director. So I remember having the conversation before Chris left, and they wanted to call it Gordon Ramsay Savoy Grill. And I said, no. It's got to be Savoy Grill. That's it. And you let the quality speak.
So, I mean, it's a famous restaurant,
Savoy. It's a famous restaurant. So you can't be bigger than that name. It's been around for 150 years. You know, even a massive name now isn't bigger than the Savoy Grill. It is an institution. So let's just let it do the work and let everybody else bring the name in.
And let people know that it's run by Gordon Ramsay's
exactly.
team.
Exactly. Yeah. Let the press talk about it. Let the article say that. That's much more, I think it's much more endearing. And it's much, it's much more of a statement of confidence in your ability. You don't need to stamp the name.
Right.
It's the quality that shines through. So I think that was where we got to with a lot of what we did and grow. The US, of course, was different, completely different, because Gordon was a huge name out there. And you needed to stamp the name on everything, because that's how the American market works. Because it's off the back of the TV, not off the back of a career of 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
It's off the back of TV. And that's how the US works differently to here. Maybe not so much these days, but certainly then it was quite different strategy.
Well, that's very interesting. So you were there for 8 years, you say, and then you decided to pursue your own strategy and start your own business. Is that right? Is that the right way of
So
you set out on your own again. Is that right?
Yeah. I finished up with Gordon Ramsay Group as CEO in 2018. January 2018 finished. And then looked that towards that next chapter of 20 years. My wife and I talked about it. I'd been away a lot as CEO and as a chef. I'd been home, but I hadn't been fully 100% at home. I was either on the phone, I was either just on emails, or I was completely consumed by something that was work-related. And when I was CEO, I was away once a month, traveling, sometimes for a week or 10 days. So when I'd come back, my plan was organize this, speak to this child. It was the same as I organized my work life. Everything was on a list, which is really bad, but it's just the way you function.
Yes.
Because you're so busy juggling things. So we looked at it and agreed that, yes, this next chapter will be different. We will start our own business. And because we do that, we're the creators, we know how to run these things. Let's just do it. So that was in 2018. We had the chat. We looked at options. And then in 2019, we launched our first business, Bank House, in Chislehurst, September 2019. So everything looked great. The world looked amazing. And hospitality had a massive opportunity to grow. And
Sun was out.
So we had six good months. And then COVID hit. But
so
still,
that must have been a bit of a nightmare, wasn't it? You made this big investment.
Yeah.
Your wife, Cecilia, and then COVID hit.
It was a nightmare, yeah, full stop. Because we just had a review by Grace Dent.
Right.
In the January, Grace Dent came unannounced, gave us this review, phenomenal review, which is exactly what you want as a local business. You know, the biggest food critic in the country at that time. She comes and gives you this amazing review and talks about how incredible it is. Why can't every local business be like this? And you start to build immediately on the back of that. And then COVID hits. So no doubt we lost all the value of that review and that positivity that had come, that we'd spent ages building towards. But it is what it is. What do you do?
You pick yourself up
and you just keep going. And then we are still a startup business 6.5 years later. There's no doubt about that, because every 6 months we have to review everything. We have to review the pricing, the menu, what works, because every 6 months the landscape has changed for the last 5 years, really. Not by choice. It's just the way the world has gone, through the economy, through the external factors, even post-COVID, all the new things came, which was the war, costs, utilities. So we are still a startup, but we just keep going. And I would say, even through all the hardship and the pain and the frustrations, the journey of working with my wife, Cecilia, and our kids has been something that I never planned, but has probably been the best thing that happened. Working with our kids, actually, who were back then aged, what were they? 18 down to 8, pretty much, or 7. So you just don't know how that's going to go. And the kids came into the business to earn some cash. We dragged them in. They were typical owner-operator kids. You know, they get dragged in, you know, often by choice and often not by choice. But
so this is a real family business.
Yeah, full on. There were times when there were 5 of us working in the business. My brother was babysitting for our youngest. He was at our house. And we were just there all working between kitchen, KP, runners, bar, front of house, the whole thing. And I'd say, that created a whole new dynamic and a whole new chapter with our relationship with our kids. So the kids had never understood what I did. They just knew they would go to lots of restaurants all the time and everything would be really great and everyone would know us. So that's what they thought life was like.
They get a front of house experience.
Kind of, yeah. But it wasn't, you know, when you look back on it, you think there's not a good way to teach your kids, because they just become so privileged in lots of ways. And so it was different because they saw their mum and dad working extremely hard, really long hours.
Right.
And dealing with so much stuff inside, outside the business. And I think it was the best chapter that we've had with the kids, where we taught them the value of hard work, of if you want something, go and do it, go and get it. And you've just got to have this work ethic. So our kids are 100% working kids. They are super hard workers. If they want something, they know that they will achieve it and they will go and get it. And they've just become those sort of adults. So James is 25, Harry's 23, and Luca's 20, almost 21. And they all, now James is digital media, so he's in hospitality in that way. He works with restaurants in central London. And then Harry's in Australia, in Sydney. He's been traveling a lot, like I did.
Right.
And he's working in Sydney in sales, and he loves Sydney at the moment. Not sure if he'll come back. And then Luca's a chef, serious chef. So Luca has gone on that path and he's fallen in love with food and become consumed by food and cooking. And he's currently at Ellen de Rose at the Connaught as a young 20-year-old
Well, good for
cook.
Him. Good for them all. And your youngest, what's your youngest doing? Still helping you?
So Arthur's 13. So he's been desperate to come into the restaurants and work for ages. For years, he's been telling me, I can earn this much, I can do this many hours. And he got fed up waiting. So Arthur, age 12, started a car wash business.
All right.
So he started a car wash business with lots of kids too. And he's got to a point where he's now 13 and he's got about 15, 16 clients regularly. He started now what they call a detailing business where he does really high levels of car washing and he earns really quite
The detailing is very impressive. Yeah,
yeah, quite amazing money because his attention to detail and his levels of, I suppose, finesse and perfection is so high, which he's got from Cecilia more than me because she's very meticulous as, you know, with perfection and, you know, in that OCD manner. So he's got all that detail. So he's suddenly creating his own business and now employing other kids who come and work with him. He drags a trolley down the street. He's got his cart. He's got, and it just
sounds like a very good education for everyone.
It's been quite phenomenal, but we didn't plan it. But I would say if we could have chosen it to be like that, we would have said, God, how could you, how could we create that?
But that's very interesting, the family aspect of this and how positive that has been.
Starting
this business together.
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. We did not expect that. And we didn't set out to do that. We didn't force our kids to do that. They just organically chose to do that. And organically, they've seen us deal with a lot of stress, drama, people, managing people, how to deal with financial situations, external factors.
You learn a lot from that.
Yeah, they're unfair, but you just need to make a plan and get on. So, yeah, I've had the best time with my, me personally, I've had the best time with my sons the last 8 years than I had for all those years where I would have thought, oh, they're seeing me as a CEO. But it was completely disconnected.
Yes.
Now they just see, they see the raw world of what you do, how you deal with stress, how you deal with everything. And it's been the biggest education for them of how to actually get on in life.
Did any of them go to university?
Only Harry. Right. Only Harry went. Harry went and studied finance and economics.
Right.
For 3 years. And yeah, don't know if it was worth it, really.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, because you learn so much doing what you've described.
Yeah, the others didn't want to. They definitely didn't. They were quite clear. James is always really artistic as a photographer and set up his own website, own company. So again, very entrepreneurial. He went out and got business with people that he was doing photography for dinner, for sketch, for the Goring, for the Connaught, for A Wong, just incredible clients with no university qualifications, just based on what he did, his talent and his website that he built, and those people seeing the attention to detail with his photography, and they're like, yes, that's our level of sophistication. And that's
I'm hearing you say attention to detail a lot, and it sort of reminded me of the early part of our conversation when you were talking about those chefs in Sweden from Austria and Germany, places that you said then had great attention to detail. Do you think this is a skill that isn't sufficiently sort of emphasized, you know, being good at the detail? Do you think we've sort of become a bit sort of grandiose and sloppy in the management of things?
Well, I think this... It's a really difficult question to answer, but I would have to say the short answer is yes. I think it's critical. I don't think I had it as a kid at all. I think I was youngest of four, pretty casual, pretty sloppy and not particularly focused in any one area. Apart from sport, I did a lot of judo and I achieved really high results in that and won lots of competitions. So I guess it was in there, but I needed the training of all those people to be extremely strict with me and disciplined that if you follow this way and you plan and you have this structure, you can achieve great things. And I think that just organically stuck with me and grew, that if you're meticulous and detailed, you can achieve
phenomenal things. What sort of disciplines or structures help to be focused in this way?
I think the basics are what you get out of every motivational book and speaker in the world. Make your plan. Get up early. Keep yourself mentally and physically fit and ready. You know, constantly challenge yourself. Never be afraid of failure. and risk. It's all internal. None of it is unachievable for anybody. All the basics, you know, like the David Goggins, you know, education of, you know, be hard, push hard, train hard. I think everyone has their own version of that, but I think it starts internally. So our son, Luca, for example, who's 20, was, for want of a better expression, all over the show. As a young 17-year-old, didn't know what to do. He was going into property and, you know, wasn't consistent, wasn't reliable. He was a classic teenage boy who was just a bit all over the show and was distracted really easily, couldn't focus on anything. And then he worked with me in the kitchen for about 6 months when I was back in the kitchen about 3 years ago, just rebuilding the structure. And he fell in love with it. He fell in love with the discipline that every single day he had to repeat and replicate the setup. And he had to check everything exactly the same way every day. And if he did that, come the busy time, he was okay.
Right.
And he just saw the beauty in being prepared and being organized for any eventuality, that then he could just get on with stuff. And I think that's really... that is impressive for other people to see. I think that attracts people to you because you're so consistently meticulous.
And it gives great confidence to people that you know what you're doing.
Confidence. I think it's the drive. You need energy to do that. You need to be driven. You need to be super focused. You don't get distracted. You can have fun, but you really have this sense of purpose. I think that's what it maybe comes down to. And that's probably the best expression I've read over all the years, is this sense of purpose. If you have a sense of purpose and a drive and a determination to get somewhere, and you might achieve it and you might fail, doesn't matter, you've got this sense of purpose that you are going to achieve this and get somewhere, I think that is incredibly infectious. Other people see it and they're like, yes, I can control all my distractions, all the noise, I can deal with all that if I just stay on point and I stay focused and I keep my own discipline, personal discipline. If I keep it really rigid and meticulous, then I can, and even the things that get in the way, they're just problems to solve, because there's always something that will stop you, but it doesn't matter. If you have a plan for that and you counter it, if you want to train regularly and you haven't got time to train, it's because you're not getting up early enough. And I'm not saying that people should get up early to do it. I'm saying you need to structure your life with what you've got to work with. So you've been dealt a hand, work with that, and then build on that. And I think then anybody can achieve, like, you know, their wildest ambitions by having that sense of structure and a sense of purpose. And if you want to build a company, that is infectious. That passion and drive is super infectious. People migrate to that so much. And when I talk about restaurants and food and different things, or even people management with our teams, I really believe and mean what I say with that. And I think that helps keep our teams together, because our teams have been with us a long time in a really complicated period of time. So there's a lot of the team has been with us 6-7 years. And we build and we grow more. But our ethos is always the same, that we're super focused. We shoot high and we want to achieve the best, and we're determined to get there. And nothing will stop us, not financial issues, not problems with people. Whatever the problems are, they're always going to be there. They're just there.
I'm signed up. I like the sound of this.
So you put me into a space there, and that's it.
That sounds right. Well, no, it's interesting, because when I asked you about number 8, your other restaurant in Sevenoaks, and all those other restaurants in the town, I mean, you said we look within and about getting it right from, you know, what's within our control, and everything you've just said so supports that. I mean, One thing I'm interested in, beyond what you've been explaining so brilliantly, is your working relationship with your wife, Cecilia. Because, I mean, quite a lot of people embark on business ventures as couples. What advice might you give them? What makes that? How do you make that work? I mean, I used to work for Gordon and Anita Roddick, who founded the Body Shop.
Yeah.
Brilliant, both of them. And learned so much from them both, but they were obviously a famous business couple too. What do business couples need to think about?
Well, I don't think it's easy. That's the first thing I'll say. I think you have to tread carefully. I think it was Cecilia and I had history already working together. We met working together. So we launched a restaurant called Teatro with Lee Chapman back in late 90s, which was a massive success on Shaftesbury Avenue and had a members club and a restaurant. So Cecilia was a young 20-something French super professional from Paris who'd been working with Marc and Pierre White. And I just come back from New York. So I was, it was my first head chef job, and I was full on and completely focused on self-achievement, I guess, or on this mission, cooking. So we worked together professionally and we clicked because she was super professional. So then we fell in love, had kids, and then Celia spent all those years giving me the space to spend 80, 90 hours a week in kitchens. And she was at home with the kids. So when we got back to working together, you don't know how it's going to work, but we clicked together within, I think, 2 weeks. Right. Like we'd never stop working together again because Cecilia is so professional. She's so focused on detail. And Cecilia's good at things that I'm not good at, which is really important, I think, in the couple. You both need to have your individual skill sets that then contribute and make you a stronger unit. So I think that was always the way it was. I'm a chef. I'm all about food. I'm all about structure and engineering systems to work. And I'm about finance and cost control, you know, because that's the career I've had and that's what I've learned. Cecilia is all about being the person that people like. So if they choose out the two people who they like best, it's always Cecilia. It will always be Cecilia 100 times out of 100 because I'm focused on just being professional and running a business. Cecilia's charming, bubbly, charismatic. She's got all the finesse of the front of the house with an immaculate training from Paris. And she's got such so much of a softer approach with the team that just wraps them in a warm, we can do this. So I think those two factors.
Sounds like a good team.
It's a good team because then, you know, if there's something to be said, I'm the guy who brings the hammer down, sits them down and says, it's not good enough. It's not good enough for this reason and that reason. This is what you're going to do. And the team are like, okay, I get it. Right. I've got direction. I'll go and do that. And so they learn. And so that's what they all want. All those people, whether they're 20 years experience or 2 years experience, they want still to learn and be structured. So a lot of our team have got a lot of experience. Some of our team are in their 50s, but they still get direction and guidance from me in certain ways, which is what they want. And I think that's very hard to find in our industry, where you can go somewhere with a lot of experience and still get developed. I think that's very difficult for people to find. And if you don't get development, you plateau. So I think, it's amazing to work together as a couple, but I think you really need to make sure you both focus on different areas of the business and you're not clashing too much. That said, when we used to have management meetings, we would often sit there and for the team, it's like being in some domestic, home argument because Cecilia would be like a teenager and I'd be saying, can you be quiet, please, Cecilia? Or I'd be telling her off at the meeting because she'd be too bubbly. And having fun with the team, and I'm trying to get some points across, and the team are just sitting there not knowing what to say.
So it's more like a family than a
board. They're terrible. Yeah, terrified. No. But I think that's been a lovely dynamic that the team really love. They love the fact that there is this dynamic, which is pure family, and it's not just corporate. It's not just a meeting of professionals. There is this whole side to it, which is ultimately what hospitality is. I think when you lose that in hospitality, you really lose that nuance of exceptional guest care, attention to detail again for the millionth time. You know, it's those little soft skills with the guest are critical. But you can't do that if you don't have, I think, your structure really well organized and your engine meticulously tuned. So then you can have fun. Mistakes can happen. You know, it's not a big deal.
Stuart, you work with your wife, Cecilia, very successfully, it seems. What if a couple is thinking of embarking on a similar business journey as you both did and are thinking of working together? What questions should a couple ask themselves before going ahead?
So tread carefully, that's for sure. Don't just think it's going to be easy, because it definitely won't be easy. To be honest, make sure you're strong as a couple. Make sure your marriage is strong and you're not doing this to fix something else, because it won't. It won't fix something else. This will be its own challenge all on its own. And you need to make sure you are strong and you have a good marriage. We have our problems in our marriage like every couple, me and Celia, but we work hard to make it work. And if you don't have that ability to talk and get through that, then it will be super tough. I guarantee. Doesn't matter what you both do within that structure. It will be tough at some point, and you can't be blaming or angry with the other person for that. And that's a natural emotion that comes out. So yeah, be a strong couple. If you've got to work on that first, work on that first.
So what about sort of back at home? I mean, are you talking business all the time, or do you have to make time where you're not going to talk about business, or does it not matter? Does one have to stop and the other begin in terms of home and business life, or is it just a sort of fusion?
So that's really tricky, I have to say, because especially when your business isn't doing so well, or you're going through a tough time, then that consumes your home life as well. So that can put your relationship under a massive amount of pressure, I'll be honest. That is just inevitable. You can't avoid that. You try and balance it out, and you try and cut it off, but ultimately you can't really.
Well, because the stakes are so high, aren't they?
You can't, yeah. Even when things are going well or you're discussing stuff, you can talk about personal things for a while, but eventually that is always going to segment back into something. Work related. Yeah, we're quite strict and disciplined with that at times when we block it out and we just talk about us, and we section that it's about us and it's about our time in the future. But you really have to be disciplined.
Do you take holidays or
not much? We do take holidays, yeah. And often they're amazing, and sometimes they're completely consumed by problems with the businesses that come up just before you go away.
Or you can get a message, or yeah, something happens.
And because I'm, you know, the head office, the term we don't use, because I am head office, because I deal with so many elements of the business, if we have to recruit, I have to focus on that. Or if there's something that comes up that's to do with an issue or payment or whatever, I have to deal with it. I can't not deal with that.
Well, we can help you with the former if you need it. So just to sort of pull this together, I mean, you've touched upon some of the challenges there of running a business. Is there a failure? I mean, you said earlier that you weren't put off by the prospect of failure. Is there a failure that you had earlier in your career that in hindsight shaped your leadership style particularly, or a failure that you look back on and think, I really learned from that and this is what I'm going to do differently?
I mean, that's tough. I mean, there's lots of failures, really, I've had. That's a fact. There's lots of things I've done wrong or badly. Mm. And hopefully lots of stuff I did well, which carried me through. But I don't know if there's one particular thing. No, it's really hard, that, actually, I have to say.
But your spirit that's coming over so strongly is to keep going. I mean, kind of maybe that's one of the lessons from the failures of the past, to keep going.
Well, I think, yeah, I think you just have to keep going. I think life will just grind you down. Whether you're doing well or whether you're not doing well in business, I think there comes a point when there are issues and obstacles, and there's adversity. And you have to see that I think that's probably it. I'd always seen adversity as something that I needed to overcome, no matter what it was. So if there was a challenge, I'm better out of my, in fact, that's the lesson. I'm better out of my comfort zone. I am better under pressure and out of my comfort zone. I did a couple of courses when I was CEO of Gordon, a couple of courses at Harvard, the exec ed courses. So they do this executive education courses where you do a big chunk of a BA course in, you know, like 10 days, and it's really intense. And you live together as this group. So you live on campus, you live together, you study together, and you're working almost like 24/7. It's super intense. And I was definitely, you know, probably the least smart person in both the courses I did, which I have no problem saying, because all the people had done a lot of these courses before. And I was a chef and newly promoted CEO. I didn't know what I was walking into. But I took the most out of those courses, that's for sure, because I just learned more about the fact of how to look at business, how to look at the future, how to look at what being a disruptor means, and also about internal focus on you, how that then impacts other people and affects other people. There was so much I learned from that just by being in that community and with those teachers. They were fantastic courses, and I think that's what Harvard puts them on for, is to teach all those values, not just stuff you can learn from a book. It's about the whole package of being a good business person, that capitalism can be good, yes, if you do it well. There's nothing wrong with capitalism if you spread the love and you spread the know, the profit. Yeah. And so that was a really big education for me. So I think the big learning was I'm better out of my comfort zone. When I'm not out of my comfort zone, I'm probably not pushing myself enough. I'm not reverting back to that, focus my mind, get up earlier, get my list done, make my plan, and go. Attack and achieve.
That's a very good point. And probably a good place to finish. I think the message of getting outside of our comfort zones is a really good one. And you exemplified that in your life, whether it's going to dangerous parts of South America or heading off to Italy with a one-way ticket. At the end of each of these conversations, I always ask the same two questions, which I'm going to ask you. And the first one, because here at Reed we love Mondays, is what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning, Stuart?
The problems from the week before, probably. But yeah, no, I'm a morning person. I've always been a morning person, and I have no problem getting up. It's the comfort zone thing again. It's that, what am I not achieving enough of? What am I not doing enough to achieve better? That's probably the thing that gets me up always. I don't look to be comfortable or relaxed, or I'm going to have a chill Monday. That probably never, ever enters my mind.
Right.
I'm always like, what haven't I thought of this week?
So you're actively seeking discomfort.
And to do better. Yeah. What can I do better?
Yeah. And the last question, which is from my interview book, Why You? 101 Interview Questions You'll Never Fear Again. That's a shameless plug, Stuart. It is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
We'll be doing the same thing. We'll be still working in hospitality. We'll have more restaurants. We will grow and we will do more. We love working with teams. And as I said, we're not fazed by how difficult that looks like. That doesn't put me off. It just means I have to work smarter and I have to plan better with the team. So that never scares me. And I think you have to have an appetite for risk and almost danger to be able to get through that. So I see myself doing the same and developing hospitality people who really need that development. They deserve to work with people who are enthused with passion and love for what they do. And from grassroots level up, from the young kids up to really senior people. We love working with all people within that structure. And we love working with people. We love the guests. We love the complexity of people. We love the challenges. And we love food and drink. We love food and drink. So
we love food and drink. And if anyone listening wants to enjoy some of Stuart's food and drink, number 8 in Seven Oaks and the Bank House in Chiselhurst both have very good ratings. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to me.
Been a pleasure, James.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, Stuart. Thank you, Stuart, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Number 8 Seven Oaks, or Bank House Chiselhurst, you'll find all the links in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.